Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, we're taking a look at Bring Her Back. New Racco Racco picture is out. A little bit more heartbreak than horror, but I'm looking forward to talking about it. Stick around for the review. It definitely does have some odd stuff. Some odd stuff going on in Bring Her Back. We're also taking a look at Mountainhead. This is from Jesse Armstrong over on HBO, writer and director of Succession, that series that ran for 4 seasons. Let me tell you, if you like Succession like I do, Mountainhead hits great. If you don't like Succession, I don't know if you're going to like Mountainhead, but I'm really looking forward to talking about it. It's about 4 billionaires who are all staying up in this Utah like mansion when kind of the world starts to end and they're all on their phones figuring out how they're going to divide power like technical autocrats. Anyway, we need to talk about a couple trailers coming up, namely new Darren Aronofsky trailer, all right, starring Austin Butler, that old Elvis, and new Guillermo del Toro trailer, yeah, for Frankenstein, which I'm looking forward to talking about, and a couple others as well. Before we get to all of it, we need to get to the news. Before we get to the news, Andy, what did you watch this week? What have you been watching when you haven't been watching Mountainhead and Bring Her Back? What's been on the watch list?
So I decided to tackle the Three Colors trilogy, which is a trilogy of films from the early 90s by Polish director Krzysztof Kieslowski. This is a trilogy that I've heard kind of a lot about and mentioned in the same breath as things like the Before trilogy, which is Before Midnight, Before Sunset, and the third one. That, of course, stars Ethan Hawke. That one is not available to stream anywhere, but the Three Colors trilogy is. And I watched the first two films, which are Three Colors Blue, Three Colors White, and the third film is Three Colors Red, which I still need to watch. These are the colors of the French flag, which is part of, I think, what it's a little bit about French society. Blue stars the great Juliette Binoche as a woman who's recently lost her husband and daughter in a car accident and is rebuilding her life. But it's not really, it's about grief, but she is not handling it the way you might think. You would think that she would be like depressed and crying and like inconsolable. And it's kind of the opposite. She's kind of thriving in despite the death. It's like she sells her house. She moves to the middle of a bustling apartment in Paris. She seems like a very free woman, but she's also struggling to connect with other people. It's a very interesting film, about 90 minutes. These are quick things. The second film, these aren't related, by the way. This is an anthology series. White is about a man named Carol. The second one stars Julie Delpy in one of her kind of breakout roles. They are getting divorced in the very beginning of the film, and he spends the whole film crashing out and trying to get her back, which is totally understandable. That film is largely in Polish and is a little bit more of a comedy. So he's exploring this idea of grief and relationships, and it's some interesting stuff, both in French, largely. So I'm still looking forward to the third one as well.
I've never seen any of them, but I've always heard they're films that are like, what we were talking about just before the show, what'd you say? Like essential reading almost for people who really want to get into film. Like it's just something to try out. It's recommended a lot. Like, hey, take a swing at the Three Colors trilogy. You know, like they've got some complex things, but like you said, totally independent of one another, right? Their anthology. What year did they come out? Do you know? I know they're older.
93 and 94.
All right. I haven't watched any of them. Like I've never taken the plunge. You're going to try the third one out, I guess, this week?
Yeah. So I've heard that that Blue and Red are the strongest of the two. White is considered a little bit weaker, but I thought that was actually fun, a little bit more fun, and kind of, it's a good breather after the first film. Also, these all take place in the same cinematic universe, which is an interesting, like you see Juliette Binoche's character just briefly in the blink and you'll miss it moment in the second film. And they're not just in the same universe, they're actually taking place at the same time. So that's pretty interesting to see. And Julie Delpy like looks incredible. She's like the Sydney Sweeney of 1994, just like an on-screen classic beauty. She looks amazing. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, when I was looking at the IMDb for that film earlier, it's like the cast list is like Julie Delpy up in like the top left, and then, you know, young, blonde. And then after that, it's like 19 white balding men who are all in their 50s and 60s. And I'm like, I don't know what this movie is about, but the cast list looks so, it's Julie Delpy, Angel on top of the tree, and then a bunch of old dudes. Like, it's very odd.
I also rewatched Demolition Man with a friend of mine who'd never seen it. It's a 1993 action movie classic starring Sylvester Stallone and Wesley Snipes. In that movie, Sylvester Stallone is accused of a crime that he didn't commit and is frozen. He's a cryo-frozen along with Wesley Snipes' character, who's the bad guy. They're frozen for 35 years. Eventually, the bad guy breaks out, and they're like, whoa, society's like too tame and too domicile now, and they don't have any way to take this guy down. So we got to unfreeze John Spartan, which is such a great movie name. Sandra Bullock also stars. So it's an action comedy satire, and a lot of the jokes really hold up. Like there's a bunch of tongue-in-cheek stuff about Arnold Schwarzenegger running for president. They have what are our equivalent of Zoom meetings. It was somehow very able to predict the future, but it's a lot of fun. Dennis Leary's also in it.
Yeah, I've never seen Demolition Man, same as you. Well, you had watched it before, but your friend hadn't seen it. I've never gone through the whole thing. I'm familiar with the memes, though, and I feel like as a child of the growing internet, I have seen so many clips of this movie and so many video essays that have mentioned it. I was just watching a Red Letter Media video the other day. They ordered from the prop store, like a recreation of Sly Stallone, like in the frozen thing. He's like, he's like naked and his face is all, he's like, ah, like, and they ordered a recreate, like that was this week. And then you said you'd watch Demolition Man. So I was like, oh my God, the footprint of this movie is undeniable. Namely the three seashells gag and Taco Bell, right? Everything's Taco Bell in the future, according to a young Sandra Bullock.
So it's actually Pizza Hut, and I could have sworn it was Taco Bell my whole life.
Are you sure? Did you watch really, it's Pizza Hut.
Maybe it's an older version, but yeah.
I could have sworn it was Taco Bell. I mean, it's all the same company, Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, KFC, the unholy trinity, yeah. PepsiCo, right? So what's the difference? But, huh. Well, that's right. I should watch the movie then. I could probably dunk on it if I knew more about it.
Yeah, it's pretty good. She is really funny, Sandra Bullock. Like she keeps doing this thing where she's like a 90s collector. She's like living in the past. Like she has this apartment that she's got collected all this 90s gear. And she's like, oh, people in the 20th century or 20th century used to do this and dress like this. And she has this gag where she keeps trying to say sayings from the past, but she kind of gets them wrong. And she's like, you can take this job and shovel it. You know, it's stuff like that. It's great. Like she's so funny in the movie. Yeah, great watch. Kind of a remnant of, it's really like an 80s action movie left over and bleeding over into the 90s.
Yeah, it's Sandra Bullock running around with adult ADHD before we knew what adult ADHD was. They hadn't figured that out in the future, Demolition Man. Now they hadn't nailed that down yet. Good for her. I watched one movie this week. I've been hanging out with that old mistress, Tubi. I don't know if you guys have heard about Tubi. Free streaming service that has a wildly diverse library because it is just like the cheapest scraps they can pick up from anybody who's willing to license content to them. I watched the 1939 film Gulliver's Travels from Paramount and the Fleischer brothers, Max and Dave Fleischer. Not a lot to this. The reason I watched it is because when I was a kid, my mom was an elementary school teacher and she had a few VHS tapes in her classroom for when, I don't know, it was a rainy day, the kids couldn't go out. And for some reason she had Gulliver's Travels from 1939. The only things that are particularly interesting about this movie are, A, you can watch the entire thing on its Wikipedia page. If you go to Wikipedia for Gulliver's Travels 39, the whole thing is there. They're like, here's the full film because it's out of copyright, so you can just watch it. And B, it came 2 years after Snow White in 37. This was Paramount's response to Disney making Snow White, and they so weren't prepared for Snow White to be a banger, and it's obvious. Despite getting nominated for 4 Academy Awards, Gulliver's Travels ultimately won nothing, and 3 years later, the entire animation studio shuttered. It's a little like Disney DreamWorks, but like in the 30s, 40s, and just a funny little bit of film history that is relevant. Otherwise, the movie is fine and has a couple of memorable songs. Yeah, that's Gulliver's Travels. That's what I watched this week. What a picture. More importantly, let's talk about the movies that we watched in the theater this week or on HBO, Bring Her Back and Mountainhead, namely. Before we get to that, when you talk about the news, what is this Netflix event? I didn't know this was coming up. I probably should have known, but I didn't. You were on it. You were looking at this stuff. What is Netflix did this fan event this week, and people have been talking about what's coming out of it, and there's been trailers. What do you know about this, Sandy?
So Netflix had their annual Ta-dum event, which is based off the sound when you start Netflix, where they announce shows, movies, things coming out. And so we have a top five of announcements from there. The big one was Stranger Things season 5 finally coming out and having not one release date, but several release dates, because they're doing kind of an interesting release strategy. They are going to release 4 episodes on Thanksgiving of this year, then 3 episodes on Christmas Day, and then the finale on New Year's Eve. So it's nearly, it's somewhere between a week release and a binge release, because Netflix is finally realizing that, hey, you kind of dump all your cultural capital if you just release it all on a weekend. And so they're doing a little bit of a elongated release, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I think this is a weird strategy. Andy's talked about this before. I feel like he was in front of this before everybody else. Like, shows have got to start doing more weekly releases. Let the hype train build, right? Like, let fans get excited about the content and share memes about the content and look forward to next week when more content is coming. Shows like FX's The Bear are suffering from not doing this because they're just dumping everything all at once. And it's like, you don't get any time to enjoy it, right? Binge watchers watch like the first episode and the last episode and everything in between. They're on their phone for half of it and they kind of miss it. So like, spreading content out, I think, is a good strategy. Like, that makes sense for Netflix. But dude, like, why are you making people wait longer for Stranger Things? Great example I saw this week of somebody comparing the amount of time between seasons of Stranger Things. Like, not only are these kids looking older, Stranger Things season 4 came out in 2022. That's the same year that The Bear on Hulu started. That was the first season of The Bear started in 2022, right? That was when season 4 of Stranger Things came out. The Bear is now on season 4, and we're just getting to season 5 of Stranger Things. And they're like, hey, you know what we should do? Pad these out and make people wait even longer for chunks of it. I know they're like feature length. Every episode is supposed to be like a movie or something, but like, we have milked it. Netflix has milked this thing for all it's worth, I think. Like, they're going to get one more good season of Stranger Things, and it's so donezo, dude. I at least till the reunion in like a decade, right?
Yeah, I watched the last full season I watched was season 3, and I like half watched it, and I didn't watch season 4 because I was just over Stranger Things by then. So I'm not going to watch this either. Again, these kids are so old. Like, Millie Bobby Brown is married. they're going to have kids of their own soon. Like, it's just taking so long. It's been 3 years since the last season. It's too long. And I'm sure there's still a built-in audience. People want to see how the story and stuff ends, but I'm just so over it. Some other announcements that we have. The Frankenstein trailer and release date come out. That's coming out in late December. We're going to talk about that a little bit more in our trailer park section. Trailer for the last season of Squid Game also came out. I haven't really been watching that. But another big announcement, Wake Up Dead Man, the third installment of the Knives Out trilogy, is going to be coming out December 12th, which was a big announcement. They had a short trailer, so we're going to be seeing that in December.
I am so split on Wake Up Dead Man. I'm excited about it. I'm looking forward to it. I liked Glass Onion. I liked Knives Out. I like what Rian Johnson's doing. But as far as we know, this is the end of his deal with Netflix. He may get another one, right? People like Fincher seem to love hanging out over Netflix and making content. But I would imagine Johnson is looking forward to getting out of the Knives Out universe. And it's kind of a shame because they're so good. And like, it's kind of a bummer that it seems like this one's going to be Benoit Blanc going for one last ride when like he's barely had a couple rides so far. It's been such a treat watching Craig like transition into this role amongst doing other stuff after getting out of Bond. Benoit Blanc is a delightful character, and the whole cast of characters around him are usually a great time too. I'm excited about Wake Up Dead Man, but I'm also like, it's almost bittersweet. It's like, we're not going to get another one of these for a minute. If they make any more, this may just be it. I don't know, but it looks good. Looking forward to it. Frankenstein looks all right. I also have not kept up with Squid Game. I tried to watch the first season and got bored. I think it was the middle of the hype train, man. Everybody was all about it, and the stupid suits and the triangles and the pink colors and the child games. And I was like, I can't do this. And then the second season came out, it was a huge banger, and then Mr. Beast made a version that's almost Squid Games, but just far enough away from intellectual copyright that he could make a show on Amazon called Beast Games. And now they're doing a third season, and like, that's huge, huge. But I'm just not into it. One more announcement, though, about Wednesday, right? Which is another show I also haven't watched.
Right. Me neither, but the Wednesday show has been a huge hit for Netflix, starring, of course, the great Jenna Ortega, and it was announced that Lady Gaga was going to be joining season 2, whenever that's out, this fall. So that's an exciting announcement. Lady Gaga is also always doing really interesting pictures. She was, of course, in last year's Joker, Folie à Deux, which she was great in, even though most people didn't see or like that film. So that's a fun announcement. But it's interesting overall. We've got some TV stuff. The film entries are interesting. Like I said, Frankenstein coming out in November and Wake Up Dead Man in December. And yeah, I'm interested to see Rian Johnson getting out of Netflix jail. There's word on the street, at least around like Disney, is that streaming is dead, which may be too extreme and hyperbolic, because streaming is definitely not dead, but it's not quite what it was. The pendulum is kind of swinging back the other way, and creatives want to get back into the theatrical space.
Yeah, like it's just for all this great stuff that Netflix announces and produces and gives money to creators that I like David Fincher and Rian Johnson. Like, I so wish they had a more open mind about theatrical releases, right? Like, we've talked about it before. We'll probably keep banging this drum for a while, man. Like, it is so bogus that if I want to go see the new Knives Out picture in theaters, I'll probably have like 6 days. If I live in a big city and I'm lucky to have a couple theaters near me that get it, maybe I can go see it for the week that it's out, just so it gets some awards like notoriety. Other than that, you got to watch it on streaming. And it's a shame, like, because I think that's where I'd like to see this stuff. Like, going to see The Killer in theaters is really cool. Going to see Glass Onion in theaters is really cool, but like, it is, who could I recommend to go do these? Because Netflix just does not operate this way. It's so lame. Their CEO, I think, Ted Sarandos, is the reason they're this way. Hopefully somebody can knock some sense in that guy, because it seems like they're making a lot of cool projects. You know what I mean? Like, put them in places where people want to go. Stop trying to drive them to your platform. I know you're Netflix and you want people to go to your platform, but like, also, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I got backwards opinions about it, I guess. What do I know? I'm not running a big streaming service. It's just a small podcast. With that, we got to talk about other news. What's going on with Karate Kid? I thought this movie was going to do okay, and I'm not a Karate Kid fan, but apparently not. This movie is struggling at the box office.
I love this headline. Karate Kid gets kicked around at the box office. Karate Kid Legends came in third place with $20 million, which was under expectations. And this had, you know, they have the show, they'd rebooted this a couple of times, and so they thought that the audience would be there, and it just didn't really turn out. This was last rebooted in 2010, 2011 with Jaden Smith. That was a big hit at the time. I think just the formula's done, the property's done. Maybe it probably should have been a straight to streaming kind of film. Didn't do too well. What is doing well are Lilo and Stitch and Mission Impossible Final Reckoning. Lilo and Stitch has crossed 600 million globally in just 2 weekends, 10 days. It's going to be nuts. Probably going to cross $1 billion, which is absolutely insane. The Final Reckoning, the Mission Impossible movie, came in second and has just crossed 350 million. So it's doing pretty well, except it was a very expensive. It was a $400 million movie, so I'm not sure how that's going to turn out. The accountants can worry about that. In fourth place, we had The Final Destination, Bloodlines, which continues to do pretty well, coming in at $230 million. And that was a $50 million film, so they're doing great. So, like, budget counts for a lot. And then rounding out the top five was actually Bring Her Back with $7 million, which we're going to talk about here in a moment.
Karate Kid Legends not doing that well is a bit of a surprise. And for all of my guff about Netflix 2 minutes ago, where I was like, they should put stuff in theaters, it's dumb to try to drive people to their platform, Cobra Kai had 6 very successful seasons on Netflix, and then the film comes out from Sony and it's just kind of a dud. And I'm sure Ted Sarandos is somewhere going, well, if you'd put it on our platform, then it would have done great. And it's like, yeah, sure, dog, but also, like, there's a lot more to it than that. It's a bummer you couldn't get the dads to turn out for Karate Kid. All right, maybe they had just gone to see Mission Impossible and they were going to double down. If anything, I would bet, since it's a male-oriented picture, that probably did draw some eyes away from it, as well as, I guess, something like Bring Her Back, which did not do that well, but certainly is going to draw teens, right? It's the horror of the week. Lilo and Stitch, I think we had to give Chris Sanders his flowers. At least according to box office, it is as successful as Disney's The Lion King or like Beauty and the Beast. It's right next to them, which are two of Disney's biggest, most acclaimed properties. And when you think of the brand, like, those are two that come to mind pretty quickly. I think we need to start talking about Lilo and Stitch probably being on that same level as like a certifiable modern classic in every sense of the word. It has made the money back. It has made spinoff shows and spinoff movies and children the world over happy with its content. So, like, it's a great property and that rocks. but man, I was really looking forward to them maybe not doing live action adaptations forever, and now it just seems like that's going to be the move, right? Like we're just going to keep making live action stuff as long as we can. Like it seemed like they were winding down. They just canceled Tangled live action. They were like, "Eh, this isn't going to work. We're not into this." And then Lilo and Stitch comes out and like makes nearly $1 billion, like crazy, crazy, crazy success. What are you going to do?
I mean, there's just not a lot in the well to go back to. I mean, after Lilo and Stitch, what's the next big hit kids movie? I mean, it's like Frozen, yeah. Which, I mean, they could do that, but I mean, they're running out of these kind of classic properties. The old stuff clearly doesn't work. Things like Dumbo, Snow White, like that's a little bit too old. Like that's your grandparents' childhood, right. Or your great grandparents' childhood. Like that's way too far back. So it's like, what did kids in the 2000s love? And there's not really a ton of Disney properties. That's when it pivoted to things like Pixar.
Yeah. I tell you, I bet they're kicking themselves because half that good Pixar library, you can't really adapt well. Toy Story is going to be clunky in live action. Cars is going to be clunky in live action. Like, I don't even know how you would do those, right? You'd have to have anthropomorphized versions of these characters, which fundamentally isn't live action. Got away with it with Lion King, so you could definitely do it. You could just do, like, photorealistic Toy Story, I guess, and it would probably make its money back. But you're right. Like, they're kind of running out of bangers here. It's on to sequels, right? That's where we're at. We're not getting Toy Story live action. It's Toy Story 5. We're going to get Frozen 3 and I don't know what else. Inside Out 3, right? Probably coming soon. In the meantime, they've got Elio coming along, which like seems like it's going to be a huge dud. Really a bummer. I couldn't believe somebody had said on Twitter that this was like Disney's first original film in like 3 years. And like, it's true. Between what they're doing with Marvel and Snow White live action and Lilo and Stitch live action and Inside Out 2, like they are not doing hardly anything original. And the only thing on the calendar that is wholly original, Elio, looks like it's going to totally miss and not make its money back unless it runs into legs like Elemental did and has success overseas like that we didn't expect. It's probably going to be a bomb. And like, I don't know. Like they need to lower how many times have I said they need to lower their budgets? They need to lower their budgets. Disney needs to make cheaper movies. I think they'd have more success.
That's definitely going to help. And June is crowded. June is so many movies coming out.
Dude, I know. Anyway, we got to move on. We got other stuff to talk about this episode. I can't hang out and rag on Disney and Netflix this whole time. They're only making more money than everybody else. We should talk about our first feature of the episode. Bit of a horror film, this one, that I'm looking forward to talking about because it's complicated and features complicated themes. Andy's going to be taking the summer on this one, so I'll get out of his way. Andy, please take it away.
Bring Her Back. So this is the sophomore entry from directors Danny and Michael Philippou, who previously did Talk to Me, which we reviewed on the show and really loved. I really liked that movie. Thought it was pretty scary. Bring Her Back stars siblings Andy and Piper, who are recently become foster children at the beginning of the movie after a family tragedy. They get moved in with Sally Hawkins' character Laura, who's really weird, really bizarre. She kind of is a little bit too excited about them coming into the house. She doesn't really respect their privacy. She's really kind of treating them like they're her children. She's just an odd woman. She has her dog is stuffed or taxidermied. Just kind of weird vibes. And there's also a third child in the house named Oliver, who is mute and walks around like half naked and has this bright red scar under his eye and is just a real weird thing. It's kind of rough with the animals, just a weird setup, and we know things aren't quite right. And we know also from the trailers that Sally Hawkins' character is grieving the loss of someone in her life who she thinks that she can try and bring back, and these children are involved in this ritual or this plan to bring someone back that maybe should stay gone. That's our very brief setup. There's a lot going on in this, a lot of themes, some interesting stuff to talk about. Zach, what'd you think?
It's an insidious host horror, right? Bring Her Back. That's what it is. We have two people who've arrived at a house and the host is insidious. And I think like Bring Her Back has a lot of stuff in it that actually works really good. There's a number of scenes in this that I actually think are really great and really enjoyable and came out talking about with friends like, hey, this scene works great. This scene works great. I don't think it's better than the sum of its parts, though. It's what it's lacking is particularly in like the horror category. Like it's just not as spooky or like overbearing as something like Talk to Me was, and it's kind of sold that way. It's marketed like from the people who made Talk to Me. It's the next weird thing, and it's weird for sure. But it's like it's a lot. It has a lot more to say about like loss and like suffering, like the sudden loss of a loved one, than it does about like ooh scared. it's way more angled at one than the other, and like with that in mind. I like it. I actually did like Bring Her Back, but I don't think it is like the next great horror feature. That's not what it's trying to be. Not what it is.
So I liked the overall story that it was going for. Again, these themes of loss and grief that a lot of movies are exploring, horror movies are exploring these days, remind me of things like Hereditary and Midsommar. It is about kind of unresolved grief. We see that the main character, or the older brother character, Andy, he's the one who found their father who had passed away, had an accident in the shower, and he's traumatized from this. He sees kind of ghosts of this. He can't take a shower because that's where he found his father in the restroom, and he's just like disturbed by it, and he's young, so he doesn't know that how to process these feelings. He doesn't have access to a counselor, these sorts of things. But Sally Hawkins' character is also dealing with these similar things where she's struggling with loss herself. We see this in the dog that she has stuffed, and that's very odd that she has a hard time letting go. So I think it's a very interesting and powerful theme. But for me personally, this movie was like a little bit too bleak and brutal and kind of unnecessarily so. It is definitely about child abuse, and there's a fair amount of it in the movie itself, which I was struggling with, and I was just like, do you really have to go there? Is it helping in terms of the story, or is it just shocking to be shocking?
Yeah, Sally Hawkins, I think, is the lightning rod at the center of this movie. She plays Laura, the mom, who's kind of taking Andy and Piper into her home. And like Hawkins, we know best from her work in like the Paddington series, right? As like the lovable mom. Shape of Water, Guillermo del Toro. Yeah, as this a very, very, very affable woman who's struggling. She's mute in that movie. She can't speak, but she's got this relationship that people don't understand. Like she's a lot of acting with her eyes, very emotional. Like Hawkins is so good at playing the mom who has lost a daughter. She's incredible at it. There's this monologue in the middle of this movie that's like one take. It's so great, dude, where she gets teary-eyed and she talks about like how meaningful her daughter was to her and how like she's never truly been able to let go of it. Incredible. The thing I think Hawkins struggles with in this movie is the insidious host. You got to be this mom who's kind of evil a little bit, right? For these kids to come in here and start to realize something's wrong and something's not right. And I think her character has a really cool arc. Like how the evil gets involved in Laura's life is actually unique in a way that I didn't expect. I thought it was going to be some goofy, ham-handed thing at the end where there's like, I don't know. I don't want to say because I don't want to spoil it. But like, it turns out to be a bit more subtle and a bit more clever, and I kind of really appreciated that. But I have trouble believing in Laura as like this mom who wants to do such bad, because she's somebody who's so good at being good. And like, I like Sally Hawkins a lot. I think her best work in here is the stuff where she's sweet and meaningful. I think the stuff that's clunky is when she's like trying to get Andy to do something he doesn't want to do, or like smacking one of these kids around, which like you mentioned, lots of abuse in this movie, lots of hitting children, which I didn't expect. Some of it's like goofy and surprising and works as a jump scare on occasion. Other stuff is like so squirmingly, achingly disgusting. I could barely look at the screen. There's one scene in particular with Oliver in here. If you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. It is so brutal, dog. I'm like writhing in my chair trying not to look at the screen because I was like, I can't look at this. Like, this is way too much. I think that stuff's used sparingly and effectively. It just seems like there's going to be so much more of it in the movie. In the trailers, it seems like it's going to be like Talk to Me, like we're going to another world and doing it. It's like way more subtle, way more. Bring Her Back is way more subtle than that. It's got its moments, but there's few peaks. It spends much more time down low in the bottom with the emotion of like losing someone, and the way that Laura connects with Andy over their shared loss of a loved one, and why they both have this similarity with water, like that's kind of unique, and like that they can have this connection together. And then Piper's a whole other thing. So yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point I forgot to mention, this is very important. Piper is blind. She is clinically blind. She can't really, she can see shapes and colors, and the Philippi brothers do a great job of actually making you feel like her, where a lot of times when a character is introduced, they're completely out of focus. You can't really see them, and so you get to feel like Piper feels. This is an extremely important plot point, because then it means Piper doesn't really know what's going on a lot of the times, because she can't see, and she, you know, she can only use so much of her senses to know what's going on. And Sally Hawkins' character takes advantage of exactly that to kind of tilt the situation. So I really like the filmmaking of this. It's just, to me, again, some of the brutality was just like a little too much. It wandered into the torture porn area for me, and I felt nauseous for a lot of the film. And when usually nothing gets to me, but it was just like just a little bit too much, and not necessarily in service of the story.
A couple other quick notes. I like the house that this is shot at and in.
Yes.
Like, it's got this triangular shaped pool in the back with like a shed. It's kind of claustrophobic. It's this odd shape. Like, it's just a clever shooting location to have a movie like this. And I don't know, just a good looking place. Like, I like that Piper's room is all like dressed up and done up. Like it's because it's Charlie's room, like Laura's former daughter. Right. And then Andy's like sleeping in the broom closet. And all, like, this crappy pop up, a door that doesn't close all the way. Like, subtle comedy, some good digs in there. And then I wanted to say, like, Danny and Michael Philippa seem to have, and I haven't seen much of their other work. I know they have a big YouTube channel, like, or they had one, and then they made Talk to Me, which I saw, and then this. I think these guys have a really interesting view of death and the afterlife. Maybe this is just a coincidence between these two movies, but like, it seems like there is nothing good at the end, and that maybe you should embrace life. Like, that's kind of their angle. Like, life is like, there's a lot of really beautiful shots in this movie. There's a great montage sequence where they're like playing outside in the rain. It's intercutting between this home video footage. Like, this idea that like the good times are here, and like we can all have a great life together here on Earth, like, and be kind to one another, is like a big theme when it runs under this idea that, like, dude, there's nothing good after you die. Like, it is gross, black, slime, disgusting, awful in both of these movies. So I don't know if this is a trend for them, if they're going to keep doing that. I don't know what to expect out of them next, because this one's a lot more emotional than I think Talk to Me was, but I liked it. I thought it was a good sophomore feature. It reminds me a little of like Jordan Peele's Us, and like, it's complex thematically and sometimes doesn't stick the landing in places for audiences, but like, solid sophomore entry, I think. And like, I don't, yeah. Any other thoughts or recommendations, Andy?
Well, I was going to say, I thought it was going to be a little bit more focused on the afterlife or the supernatural, the ritual. And that's only a really small part of it. I wanted to mention a little bit about, excuse me, the filmmaking. For example, Laura's talking about she has lost her daughter, and they asked what happened. She said, well, her daughter Kathy drowned. And then the very next shot is of her backyard with an empty pool, the pool that presumably she drowned in, which has been since drained, you know. So it's like, oh, it's just such a great smash cut to this next. And there's so much of that in this film. Like, the filmmaking, I think, is really excellent, and I'm excited to see what they do next.
Yeah, the idea that Laura has to live looking at that pool every day, like a literal hole in her heart outside made manifest, like that she can't get away from and escape, like crazy. Even like this circle that's drawn around the property in white, like it's there for a particular reason. You watch the movie, you'll find out. But like this visual idea of being trapped or like locked off in your own space, like, yeah, like there's a ton of really great themes and ideas in here. I just feel like it, I don't know, it's somehow, it can't be both. It can't be like this great emotional thing and also this brutal horror film. Like, it's got to be one or the other. And I feel like it doesn't quite stick it either way. It ends up being this like amalgamation of the two. Yeah, that's Bring Her Back. I feel like I'm saying it's bad. That's not what I'm saying. I think it's a good time. I like Bring Her Back. But yeah, it's odd for sure. Anyway, recommendations, Andy? Would you recommend
Bring Her Back? I'm ready. I've actually told most people to pass on this because it is so brutal. There was someone who was going to see it the day I did, and I said, maybe you might want to skip it, just because I kind of knew their personal history a little bit. So I would say, unless you're incredibly interested in it, it's going to be kind of a soft pass for me because it is so brutal. The performances are good. The filmmaking is good. Just the story probably should have been dialed back a little bit, or the brutality could have been dialed back in service of the story more.
Yeah, I think I'd recommend it to horror heads, or like if you're a big Sally Hawkins fan and you're wondering why she hasn't done anything in a couple of years and wasn't in Paddington 3, I guess this was it. Solid, like I think if you're in that camp. But yeah, if you're just looking for something casual, like I don't think this is quite it for you. This is, it's got some lofty themes, big ideas playing around and Bring Her Back. And if you want something to analyze, spend a little time with, solid, I think. Content warning, yeah, definitely some gross stuff going on for sure. Yeah, that's Bring Her Back. Not a bad picture. Not a bad picture by any means. Somebody got a fix. Somebody's gonna be in the YouTube comments telling me I said it sucked. That's not what I'm saying. I think it's good. I really do. I think it's solid. I'm looking forward to seeing what they do next. We gotta talk about some trailers. Some stuff coming up. What do we call this segment?
It's time for the trailer park. So we have four trailers to bring you. Zach's gonna start us off.
Yeah, I'm lucky, man. I got caught stealing here, the first trailer. This is the new Darren Aronofsky picture, who we have not seen make a movie since The Whale, which we covered on this show. Caught Stealing is the story of burnt-out ex-baseball player Hank Thompson, played by Austin Butler, hot off the heels of his performance as Elvis in Baz Luhrmann's Elvis. Hank Thompson finds himself embroiled in a dangerous struggle for survival amidst the criminal underbelly of 1990s New York City. IMDb is doing me such a solid here, dog. Forced to navigate a treacherous underworld he never imagined, involving an odd neighbor playing a punk rocker played by, God, what is his name?
Matt Smith.
Matt Smith, that's it. I'll say the best part of Morbius. Matt Smith, former Doctor Who, Matt Smith, yeah. When Hank agrees to basically watch his apartment for a weekend while Matt is away, Russ is his character, the punk rocker is away. He's hanging out with his girlfriend, Zoe Kravitz. Things are all good. But then a couple of hoods show up and they say, hey, your buddy owes us some money and he's not here, so you owe us money. This turns into a whole how to do that looks a lot like something like Fargo, like a Joel and Ethan Coen picture. Bit of violence, bit of fun, some punk rock. Caught Stealing. What do you think, Andy?
I think this looks like a lot of fun, and it actually reminds me more of something like a Guy Ritchie film. Things like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels or Snatch, and more recently The Gentlemen. It's more of that style of like kind of gangster show with lots of characters and intertwining lines. It's really different for Aronofsky because he usually makes kind of heavier material. He's made things like Black Swan, The Wrestler, Requiem for a Dream, Mother from several years ago. So he usually kind of is making real heavy features, and this is like the most fun thing I've ever seen him make.
Yeah, really looking forward to it. Like typically he's making stuff that's, yeah, rough, and this looks like, well, I saw somebody on Twitter say it great, like, oh, thank God Aronofsky's making a normal movie again. It'll be a good exercise, I think, at least. Like, I think the man's perfectly capable, but, like, it's nice. It's nice when you see a director break out a little bit out of, like, kind of the mold they seem to have been in for a while. So, probably a banger. What's next?
Frankenstein, which we talked about earlier in the show, the Netflix version. There were actually two competing Frankenstein pictures coming out. Maggie Gyllenhaal is doing the other one with Christian Bale as the monster. That ended up getting delayed, so we have Guillermo del Toro's version. And what we see, why can't I think of his name? Oscar Isaac as Victor Frankenstein, the scientist behind it all. And we see this kind of scenes. It sets a lot of mood, lots of stuff on a ship out in the snow, which is famously where Frankenstein kind of ends the book. We have voiceover from Oscar Isaac. We have him building the monster, and they hide the monster from most of it. Which is going to be played by Jacob Elordi, also starring Mia Goth. It's a lot of a vibes trailer. It looks great. And Guillermo del Toro loves doing monster movies. That's his whole thing. And so everyone's really excited about it. People are actually clamoring for Netflix to do a theatrical release because it looks that good. And it's one of these things that might be kind of one of their Oscar films because it's being released in November.
I hope Frankenstein rocks. I'm usually looking forward to the new Guillermo del Toro, whatever he's making. I'll check it out. And he is one of these directors like Fincher or Ryan Johnson, who's pretty firmly in the Netflix camp, right? Pinocchio, which was nominated for a couple Academy Awards, that came out on Netflix. Like, this is now a Netflix joint. Like, they got my man in the stable. But he seems to be able to make some creative stuff. I hope it's good. I don't know a whole lot about what's going on. I like that they're keeping Jacob Elordi out of the public eye, but otherwise, Frankenstein seems like it's going to be a banger. Big fan of Oscar Isaac. When does this come out, Andy? Do you know?
No, just November 2026. This
November.
Probably around Thanksgiving, I think.
2026?
Sorry, 2025. Year? Wrong.
Oh, thank God. Wrong. I was like, this is this one of those movies? Dude, you remember when they kicked Nosferatu back a whole freaking year? It just had to sit on it. Gosh, Robert Eggers was like, it's nearly done. You're going to wait till next December. Crazy. Anyway, yeah, Frankenstein looks great. Speaking of Netflix, I want to talk about the trailer for Happy Gilmore 2. All right, so I'm a bit of a Gilmore head. What can I say? I think I was talking with Andy about this earlier this week. I think Happy Gilmore is my favorite of Adam Sandler's early goofy voice movies, where he's playing like Billy Madison or God, Bobby Boucher and The Waterboy, or even like Little Nicky, which was a huge flop. Even something like Eight Crazy Nights, where he's doing a whole bit. But like Happy Gilmore was the one where I was like, okay, he's just a mad idiot, right? Like Happy Gilmore is capable of paying a rent check and driving a car. He's just angry all the time and he's dumb. I can deal with that. And I enjoyed the golf stuff. So seeing a trailer for Happy Gilmore 2, I was looking forward to seeing my old friend Christopher McDonald trot back out as Shooter McGavin and be the villain of the whole thing. He definitely doesn't seem like he's going to be the villain of the whole thing. The plot is currently under wraps. IMDb doesn't even have it, so I can't lean on them this time. But what I do know is that Happy Gilmore, played by Adam Sandler, is coming out of retirement to hit the links again and hopefully make some cash for probably some kind of important reason, just like the first one when he had to save his grandma's family home, right? Like, got a bunch of people back in it. Christopher McDonald is back and teased at the end. Julie Bowen is back as Virginia Vennett, who is his girlfriend from the first one. I assume they probably worked it out. Also, quite the list of guest stars in here, including Margaret Qualley, show favorite. Ben Stiller is back. Benny Safdie, Eric Andre, Nick Swartzen, Bad Bunny, Eminem is in this movie. It's going to be a whole... Travis Kelsey's in here. It's going to be a whole how-to-do. So it's Happy Gilmore 2. Andy, what do you think?
It sounds like key jangling the movie. The trailer looks fine, though. It does look like a who's who of Saturday Night Live players, both past and present. It's going straight to Netflix. I'm sure it'll be fine. It definitely looks like a nostalgia fest, but it's Happy Gilmore. It's not like you need to push the story deeply forward or anything.
No, I think it will be truly terrible. I would imagine it will be absolutely awful. And I'll watch it and be kind of frustrated how it was. But, you know, then I'll go back and rewatch the first one and feel like this is completely independent from that because this was made in a world where, you know, that first one, whatever. It'll be fine. I'm with you, though. It looks awful. It looks like a cash grab. It's all it is. It's solid. One more to talk about. What do you got?
This trailer just came out today. A Big, Bold, Beautiful Journey. That's quite the mouthful. So this is Margot Robbie's first film since Barbie. She took quite a lot of time off. She had a child in the meantime. This is a little bit of what looks like a romance fantasy, also starring Colin Farrell. Our two characters meet and kind of a meet cute rom-com setup where they bump into each other on a trip, but then they go on some sort of fantastical journey where they're going through these doors and like they're going through these doors, like his high school doors, and it leads him to looking into the past, and she's going through a hospital door and it's her like reliving someone's grief. And so it's a very fantastical thing. Remind me of things like Eternal Sunshine or The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. Beau's Afraid actually reminded me some. This comes out in September, and I can't really put my finger on it with this trailer. I can't tell if this is like just going to be like middling garbage or it's like going to be profound and deep, but I think it's probably going to be somewhere in the middle. It looks like the kind of stuff that Robert Zemeckis would make today.
This looks like the kind of movie that will almost assuredly underperform at the box office. I hope it was a cheap shoot. I'm glad Robbie's back. I love Margot Robbie. And for what it's worth, I like Colin Farrell fine. I go for movies like this. I like Walter Mitty. Like I think Walter Mitty's an underrated Ben Stiller picture. I really do. So I'm at least interested, but like, movies like this do not particularly perform well. It feels like it'd be something to go straight to streaming. I'm hoping it's got real heart because that's what's going to need to carry this through. It's going to have a couple really powerful scenes or something that people leave the theater and immediately go tell their friend about, like, oh my God, you got to see this thing. It's so great. That's what I got for Big Bold Beautiful Journey. I'd love for this to be a banger. I go for imaginative journey stuff like this. Like a couple of good stars in the middle of it, low budget. Hey man, that sounds awesome, but like I don't know who turns out for it still. We just live in a different world now. Speaking of different world, go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say, I think also this genre of film is very, very hard to make work. You gotta really thread the needle where, yeah, it's, you gotta have fantastical things, but then like you said, it's gotta have heart. It's gotta grab you. Again, Eternal Sunshine is probably the best example of this. We can probably name 10 failed examples of it instead. Yeah. So I just think it's a really hard thing. It's gotta have like the perfect script to work.
Yeah. I would imagine it's based on a book. I don't know for sure, but I'm betting it's based on a book. And if so, maybe the book's got a big audience. Like for here, Andy and I are talking about on our movie podcast. Like it might be based on a book. Like probably could be one of the best sellers of last year. I wouldn't even know it. But yeah, that's a Big Bold Beautiful Journey. I'd love it to be great. I like Colin Farrell and Margot Robbie. I would love them both to get a huge bag. Let me be clear. This is important. But yeah. Anyway. We got to talk about one more film before we wrap up the episode. I'm really looking forward to talking about this one. I was skeptical going in, but I'm a Succession fan, so I figured that maybe there'd be something here that I'd enjoy. Turns out there is. The fear is, I think if you're not into Succession, I don't know if this movie's going to do anything for you. Let's get into it. Andy has not seen a lot of Succession. I've seen all of it and love it, so I think we've got two good perspectives here. The movie is Mountainhead. So, Mountainhead is the new project from Jesse Armstrong, creator, writer, kind of showrunner behind Succession on HBO. They did 4 seasons of that show, got nominated for a ton of Emmys. It is a great watch, would highly recommend. And Mountainhead feels like it comes right out of the world of Succession. It might as well be a spinoff. It could take place in the same world and totally work great. Mountainhead is the story of four... I'm going to say really obnoxious billionaires. And they don't start obnoxious, but as the film goes on, you begin to learn more about them. Can't be too surprised. Who all meet at this annual retreat up in Utah at this wonderful house called Mountainhead. It's almost like a ski lodge that one of them owns, to hang out and reset their minds for the future. And while they're there, they get on their phones and they start seeing the news and start realizing that things are truly going wrong in the world, almost immediately so, due to the launch of one of their app's new features. And when the world is changing rapidly, what are these four technocrats to do but maybe jump in and change things themselves for the worse? The movie stars Steve Carell as Randall, our first of 4 billionaires, who is the old money billionaire. He's like in his late 50s, 60s. He's got gray hair. Looks great, but he's older for sure. And actually, at the beginning of the film, has recently received a negative health diagnosis, one of a few from a few different doctors, but he doesn't believe it. He says, look, I think you guys can fix me. Science can make it happen. We're gonna find a cure. You've got Jason Schwartzman, who plays Hugo, who everybody refers to in the group as Super, who owns Mountainhead, this place in Utah, but is not quite a billionaire. There's a great scene early in the film where they all establish how much money each of them is worth, and he is in the 500 million category. Not quite there, but he hosts every year, and he does things for these guys, and they all kind of bring him along because, well, you know, he's super, and he's great, and maybe some of them see him as a friend, but maybe others see him as functionally a server, right? Some kind of service for them. But he is trying to get his app launched called Slozo, which is a lifestyle super app, they call it in the movie, which is really just a lame meditation app, and the other three billionaires all know it. He's hoping he can get an investment from one of them. Corey Michael Smith plays Venice, Venice is his name, who is functionally our stand-in for somebody like Elon Musk. He's like in his 30s, 40s, he has this huge app named Trammer, I think it's called, which is a lot like Twitter. And just at the beginning of the movie, their app has launched this all new deepfake AI service that can make fake footage out of anything, which is creating problems all around the world. In Argentina, there's now a revolution. And in France, people are protesting because they saw this footage of this thing that wasn't real. And nobody can figure out what's real and what's not on the internet anymore. And Venice is kind of the center of that whole thing. And as the richest billionaire, $225 billion, he's easily the most successful out of all of them and has the most influence on the world, but also is kind of the reason it's all going belly up and just refuses to see it. And lastly, there's Jeff, played by Rami Youssef, young comedian, who is it's seemingly our heart and soul of the movie. He is the youngest billionaire whose AI platform is up and coming. He is rapidly approaching Steve Carell's Randall's wealth, but he isn't quite there yet. He's got more money than Super for sure, but you know, he might just go somewhere one day until, following Venice's app launch, he starts to gain a lot of value over the weekend, and that starts to dynamically change their relationship. The four of them are all awful. They're all vapid and terrible, just like our characters in Succession, and this is the setup for what turns out to be a comedy, where these four billionaires all arrive at this place and are all talking out their asses about how the world should be run, and really, none of them has any great idea. They're all super selfish, and as the weekend goes on, they begin to devolve into horribly petty personal politics that have so little to do with the world around them, but may have great influence simply because the amount of money and resources that these four men control. It's a lot like Succession. It is very similar to it. And as a Succession fan, I enjoyed Mountain Head. I thought it was really clever. But I'm looking forward to talking about how it shot, the tone of it, and most importantly, if somebody who doesn't know Succession is into this. So with that, Andy, what did you think of Mountain Head?
So originally, I wasn't really too interested in seeing this movie because I just thought it felt really out of touch. But I was actually glad that we watched it, because our characters are so different and they represent different types of people in the real world. Venice is kind of a mixture of tech moguls. It's like he's a mixture of Elon Musk, Zuckerberg, Steve Jobs, even, and while they're all kind of high on their own supply, Rami Youssef is actually kind of the most grounded person. He keeps pointing out, he's like, hey, your app is actually causing all this destruction, you know, there's all this violence, you know, should we do something about it? He's kind of the most conscious of these, and it is a good balance to them. I feel like the bit goes on a little bit too long. I was with it for like 3/4 of the way, and then in like the last 20 minutes I was struggling. I was like, all right, let's wrap this up, because it is a little bit like a bottle film, and it's a little bit like a play because it's just four guys talking in rooms. But I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to.
Yeah, it's a shame. It seems like the stakes are going to get much higher in Mountain Head than they actually do. There's a turn in act two that makes it seem like violence is very immediately on the table for the group, and then they kind of don't actually get to where it seems like it might. And it's a shame, because when you present a sort of Chekhov's gun to your audience, it seems like, oh boy, something cool is going to happen here. And then it doesn't. And it's not, the comedy of that comes from the fact, not that they are not capable of committing violence, but that they're all so selfish and small and soft in reality that when they're not surrounded by sycophants and an army of yes men and yes women will do whatever they want, these four billionaires have no real relationships in their lives, any of them. Like Jeff, Rami Youssef's character, who's supposed to be, like you said, kind of our soft emotional core. He's the one who's like, hey guys, maybe we shouldn't be telling the president to go F themselves, and maybe we shouldn't be playing global politics here. He also like has a girlfriend who he like can't look in the eye and like can't talk to and have a real relationship with, even though he's so obviously should be capable of talking to another person. He can do deals. He can do business negotiation to billions of dollars. But when it comes to like having a real relationship, the only people he can really hang out with is his three other friends here, who are really kind of rivals and really only relate to him because of the amount of money and influence they have. Meanwhile, like Venice, played by Corey Michael Smith, who's really brilliant in this movie, he has a son, it's revealed part of the way through the movie. In no way is he a father. Like, nothing about him says that this man's a father figure. And then you actually get this kid, they bring this baby out to him, and he's like outside in his bathrobe, doesn't invite him in. Oh yeah, let me hold him for a second. Like, puts him on the concrete, watches him play around. The other guys are like, this is awful. Like, none of them have any real relationships in their lives. Like, and this makes all of them incredibly insecure and incredibly narcissistic. This is the kind of thing that I really liked about Succession. Like, the way that Armstrong manages to write these characters is like so truly lacking, despite the fact that they have every resource available to them. And when things start to go wrong at the cabin, like bad news coming out of foreign countries that they're all watching on Twitter, or like the water not working anymore for some reason, and one of them going, well, maybe it's a plot by the Canadian government and we gotta get out of here, you know, like that all creates like a bit of a boiler pot for these four people who are basically just man children, like walking around, like to have to try to figure out what's next and what they're going to do. And it starts fun. It starts with like, oh, maybe I'll place a call to the power company in Argentina and start rolling blackouts, right? And that might influence this. And it starts coming around to like, hey, we should start a coup to overthrow the U.S. Like, that'd be awesome, right? Like, who could run logistics on this? Can we get a model for this? Can we map this out? That's the stuff I enjoyed so much about Succession. That makes this very enjoyable for me. For like the virgin viewer, though, dude, who hasn't seen any of that, I think that all flies right over people's heads and they just miss it. And this all seems lame and corporate speak and doesn't work.
I think it works for the first half, and it worked the most for the first half for me. Cause yeah, that's when those things are happening where it's like, oh, there's a coup happening in this country, or all these states are failing. And they're like, well, maybe we should overthrow the US. Like, that stuff is really interesting. And then I think it just kind of runs out of steam towards the end. But what you were saying about how the characters are so kind of lacking and insecure, I think is really brilliant, particularly Corey Michael Smith, who we previously saw in Saturday Night, and also a small role in May December. He's so perfect as this like bravado jackass character who's so overconfident but so obviously insecure in everything that he's just overcompensating the entire time. And it's like there's a lot of real life people that you could see being this way, but he is so pitch perfect for that role.
Yeah, it's no coincidence that like three out of these four, and I'm only speaking of Corey Michael Smith because I don't know his work more outside of film, but like three of these guys have heavy backgrounds in comedy. Like, because that's a lot of what's going on here. Like, it presents like a drama, especially the trailer. It's a lot of like big music and like stings, and like the stakes have never been higher. And then you actually watch it and it's like, it's a lot more like Dr. Strangelove. It's like these four guys who are all in this like bunker away from everybody, just speculating about how they couldn't run the world. And almost every idea is bad and dumb, but nobody's going to tell them no because they're billionaires. And that's how it works, right? I want to talk about the way this is shot really quickly. That's important. This was a fast shoot. They shot this in 10 days. Real fast turnaround. And I think they shot it in 10 days because it's shot much like Succession, which is what Jesse Armstrong knows. I think it's roaming camera people, like three or four cameras, roaming around a room where the actors are playing out the scene almost like a play, usually in full. They do three or four takes of that. Like, the camera people are free to crash zoom or pan or move however they feel like is necessary in the scene, whatever flows organically. And then they cut that together. Like, that's your scene. And it works real good in Succession. Like, they were nominated for a couple Emmys for it. Like, people praise kind of like its innovative presentation. But it's not very theatrical. And this works on HBO, watching on a small screen. But if I was watching this in a theater, I feel like I would have just felt like it's just a Succession movie, which is great if you're a Succession head. But like, again, like, this is supposed to be outside of that space. This is like, imagine this is a feature film. This is Jesse Armstrong's first feature. Like, that's what this is. So the fact that it borrows so much from his previous work, I don't want to say it hurts it, but it's a bit of a shame. It's not the whole thing, especially later in the movie. Like, the last few scenes, they're almost all lockdown tripod, which I think was specific and implicit and important because it shows a sort of like settling from like this handheld look that we have the whole time, like a bit of a denouement. What am I trying to say? Resolution, I guess, visually, like in our cinematography. But I would like to see more of that. Like, let's get a little bit more, I don't know, maybe work with a different crew or something. Like, again, if you're a Succession head, hits great. If you're not a Succession head, I don't know. I don't know if it does it for you.
And see, actually, for me, I think because I didn't watch, I watched like two episodes of Succession, but because I'm not as familiar with that show, I think it actually, it is new and different for me because I'm not as familiar with the show. So like I said, it was working for me for a large majority of it. I think it just goes on too long. It's nearly 2 hours, and I think it's more of a 90-minute idea. Just needs to be a little bit tighter, especially in the end. But it was promising, I think.
Yeah, I think it's maybe a black comedy. I was trying to decide whether or not it was, because ultimately the themes that they're talking about, the reason the world is crumbling, is wildly dour and feels very apt. Like, these guys are all talking about deepfakes and AI, which is a problem everybody is thinking about, right? They're all on their phones, on the equivalent of like Twitter and Facebook. And these are fundamentally the companies these guys run. I mean, they even have like CNN in here, right? Like, they have CNN news chyrons and stuff running news. Like, it's very grounded in a reality we're all familiar with, just like Succession. But the way these people act in that setting, what seems like such a boiler pot, is what makes for your entertainment and your viewing pleasure. Like, that's what Jesse Armstrong is trying to nail, I think, with this stuff, is that these guys are human just like everybody else. And despite the fact that they have overblown egos and they have convinced themselves that, like, they are ultimately the purveyors of, like, the future and what's to come next, they're not. They're all struggling. They're all suffering. In the case of Steve Carell's character, he is literally diagnosed with an illness that there doesn't seem to be a cure for. He is on borrowed time. So, like, this idea that the four of them get together and have this little retreat at the beginning of the film seems so surface. And by the end of it, you realize, like, these are the only real connections these guys have. It's like the Breakfast Club. Like, you're never going to have better friends than this. You know what I mean? Like, what an odd thing to try to tackle in 90 minutes. But I enjoyed it. I thought Mountain Head was cool. I'm glad it didn't come to theaters. I'm glad it was a straight to streaming, I think, because it's not particularly theatrical. But with all that said, Andy, I got to know, would you recommend Mountain Head?
Yeah, I think overall I would. It's an interesting premise, and I think our performances are really strong. I think the bit just goes on a little bit too long. I think if it were 10, 15 minutes shorter, it would be a little bit stronger of a film. It's taking on a lot of very contemporary things about AI and deepfakes and the role of technology and society and government and all those things. It's a funny, easy time. Again, if you've seen Succession and you're into that style of comedy, I think you probably enjoy it as well. So I'd say it's on streaming, it's on Max. So check it out if you think that that's your thing.
Yeah, I'd recommend it to a particular audience. If you're somebody who went for Succession, or something a little elevated like The Big Short or like Margin Call, you'd probably like this. It is particularly timely. And he kind of nailed it with, like, in the way it feels like a bottle feature. It feels like a pandemic movie. And we watched a few movies through the pandemic, and it feels like that particularly because it's a small setting and it's very timely subject. Like, these are things that people are thinking about often, like these kind of ideas of self-destruction through technology. So, like, it's cool that that's something that this tackles. Can be maybe a little bit overwhelming, especially in the first bit. I was like, dude, this is heavy stuff, but I liked where it ends up getting. I enjoyed it. And yeah, as somebody who enjoyed Succession, I'd say this is a absolute watch. And if you've never seen Succession, give it a shot. Try it out. See what you think. Just keep in mind that it's meant to be laughed at, that these people are not meant to be heroes, that they are meant to be a joke. And that's kind of the approach that you should be coming at them with. And I think it makes for a better time, even if sometimes they end up being more villainous than not. And that's Off-Script episode 295, dude. We're blowing through it. Hot on our way to 300, which is crazy. I don't know how we got here. Ooh. It's nuts. Big plans for that episode, I'm sure. I'm sure we're going to come up with something so hot you guys won't even be ready for it. But right. In between now and then, what are we watching next week, Andy?
So next week, we got two in theater things we're going to see. Ballerina, which is the full title, is actually From the World of John Wick. Ballerina is the actual title, which is kind of nuts. But that spinoff starring Ana de Armas comes out this week in From the World of John Wick. So we'll see what that's all about. I'm excited to see that. It's going to be interesting to see if that series can continue with her at the lead. A lot of times these action films kind of don't do very well when you switch who the lead character is. We know that they reshot some stuff to get some Keanu Reeves stuff in there, and I think this technically takes place before the fourth movie or between the third and fourth movie, so that's one we're watching. The other one is, of course, Wes Anderson's The Venetian Scheme, which is also in theaters this weekend. Really excited for that. Probably the first time I've been excited for a Wes Anderson film. Not a big fan, but I am actually looking forward to this. And just an FYI release, the Pharrell Williams documentary, Lego documentary, Piece by Piece, is going to be on Netflix starting this weekend as well. But Ballerina and The Venetian Scheme for next week.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to Ballerina, at least in the way that, like, I wish I was still right now. I'm trying to diet. I'm on a cut, G, and I'm not eating popcorn, which is a bummer because Ballerina is, like, so prime for a big bucket of popcorn, dude, at the movies. Like, oh my God. Go turn your brain off, get in the dark room and eat junk food for 2 hours and watch people wail on each other. Starring Ana de Armas? Come on, it's probably great. Meanwhile, Phoenician Scheme is much more perfect for, like, crossing your legs and ordering a coffee, right? Like, you know, just chilling. So it's going to be a good time. Looking forward to both. If you want to hear our reviews for both those movies, best way to do that is come back next week. Easiest way to do that is subscribe to the show so you get some kind of sweet notification right when the episode comes out. I think it'll be out Tuesday next week. Yeah, I think we're good for I'm good for Tuesday. You're good for Tuesday, yep. Right, Andy? Tuesday it is. Sick. Yep. Just got live on the show. Yeah, you can subscribe to the show to get the new episode when it comes out. It'll be over on YouTube. You can subscribe over there. Big things going on YouTube, so come check us out. It'll be on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, all your social media places. You can find us. We're hanging out. Come give us a follow over there. Comment. Let us know what you thought of the show. You can find us on audio platforms, Spotify, Google Play, iHeartMedia, iTunes. If you want to take us on the go, you got some walking or running or something to do, working out, whatever. Throw your boys in those eardrums, all right? We'll get down on it. And you can check out our website, offscriptfilmreview.com. You can email us correspondence directly at mail@offscriptfilmreview.com. That's it for Offscript episode 295, the home of Bold Cinema. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.